Observing new thought brings new thought to your fingertips. Hello, welcome to a Divine Waves production sponsored by Serving New Thought. Visit www.newthoughtlibrary.com. These digital recordings are part of an ongoing series empowering people around the world with high-quality readings of seminal New Thought classics. Special thanks to the Mana Group of Florida for their wonderful support to purchase equipment. Now, we present the Edinburgh Lectures, read by Dr. Michael Spottiswood, the voice of Thomas Troward.
Chapter 11. Healing. The subject of healing has been elaborately treated by many writers, and fully deserves all the attention that has been given to it. But the object of these lectures is rather to ground the student in those general principles on which all conscious use of the creative power of thought is based, than to lay down formal rules for the specific applications of it. I will therefore examine the broad principles which appear to be common to the various methods of mental healing which are in use, each of which derives its efficacy not from the peculiarity of the method, but from it being such a method as allows the higher laws of nature to come into play. Now the principle, universally laid down by all mental healers, in whatever various terms they may explain it, is that the basis of all healing is a change in belief. The sequence from which this results is as follows. The subjective mind is the creative faculty within us, and creates whatever the objective mind impresses upon it. The objective mind, or intellect, impresses its thought upon it. The thought is the expression of the belief. Hence, whatever the subjective mind creates is the reproduction, externally, of our beliefs. Accordingly, our whole object is to change our beliefs, and we cannot do this without some solid ground of conviction of the falsity of our old beliefs and of the truth of our new ones. And this ground we find in that law of causation which I have endeavored to explain. The wrong belief, which externalizes as sickness, is the belief that some secondary cause, which is really only a condition, is a primary cause. The knowledge of the law shows that there is only one primary cause, and this is the factor which in our own individuality we call subjective or subconscious mind. For this reason I have insisted on the difference between placing an idea in the subconscious mind, that is, on the plane of the absolute and without reference to time and space, and placing the same idea in the conscious intellectual mind, which only perceives things as related to time and space. Now, the only conception you can have of yourself in the absolute or unconditioned is as purely living spirit, not hampered by conditions of any sort, and therefore not subject to illness. And when this idea is firmly impressed on the subconscious mind, it will externalize it. The reason why this process is not always successful at the first attempt is that all our life we have been holding the false belief in sickness as a substantial entity in itself, and thus being a primary cause, instead of being merely a negative condition resulting from the absence of a primary cause. And a belief which has become ingrained from childhood cannot be eradicated at a moment's notice. We often find, therefore, that for some time after a treatment, there is an improvement in the patient's health, and then the old symptoms return. This is because the new belief in his own creative faculty has not yet had time to penetrate down to the innermost depths of the subconscious mind, but has only partially entered it. Each succeeding treatment strengthens the subconscious mind in its hold of the new belief until at last a permanent cure is effected. This is the method of self-treatment based on the patient's own knowledge of the law of his own being. But there is not in all men this knowledge, or at any rate not such a full recognition of it as will enable them to give successful treatments to themselves. And in these cases the intervention of the healer becomes necessary. The only difference between the healer and the patient is that the healer has learned how to control the less self-conscious modes of the spirit by the more self-conscious modes, while the patient has not yet attained to this knowledge. And what the healer does is to substitute his own objective or conscious mentality, which is will joined to intellect, for that of the patient, and in this way to find entrance to his subconscious mind and impress upon it the suggestion of perfect health. The question then arises, how can the healer substitute his own conscious mind for that of the patient? And the answer shows the practical application of those very abstract principles which I have laid down in the earlier sections. Our ordinary conception of ourselves is that of an individual personality which ends where another personality begins. In other words, that the two personalities are entirely separate. This is an error. There is no such hard and fast line of demarcation between personalities, and the boundaries between one and another can be increased or reduced in rigidity according to will. In fact, they may be temporarily removed so completely that, for the time being, the two personalities become merged into one. Now, the action which takes place between healer and patient depends on this principle. The patient is asked by the healer to put himself in a receptive mental attitude, which means that he is to exercise his volition for the purpose of removing the barrier of his own objective personality and thus affording entrance to the mental power of the healer. On his side also, the healer does the same thing, only with this difference, that while the patient withdraws the barrier on his side with the intention of admitting a flow in, the healer does so with the intention of allowing a flow out. And thus, by the joint action of the two minds, the barriers of both personalities are removed, and the direction of the flow of volition is determined. That is to say, the flow is from the healer as actively willing to give, towards the patient as passively willing to receive, according to the universal law of nature, that the flow must always be from the plenum to the vacuum. This mutual removal of the external mental barrier between healer and patient is what is termed establishing a rapport between them. And here we find one most valuable practical application of the principle laid down earlier in this book, that pure spirit is present in its entirety at every point simultaneously. It is for this reason that as soon as the healer realizes that the barriers of external personality between himself and his patient have been removed, he can then speak to the subconscious mind of the patient as though it were his own, for both being pure spirit, the thought of their identity makes them identical, and both are concentrated into a single entity at a single point upon which the conscious mind of the healer can be brought to bear, according to the universal principle of the control of the subjective mind by the objective mind through suggestion.
Listening to the Edinburgh Lectures, read by Dr. Michael Spottiswood, the voice of Thomas Troward. Audio downloads of this and other wonderful New Thought classics are available through www.divinewaves.com, and the books are available for study at www.newthoughtlibrary.com.
It is for this reason that I have insisted on the distinction between pure spirit, or spirit conceived of apart from extension in any matrix, and the conception of it as so extended. If we concentrate our mind upon the diseased condition of the patient, we are thinking of him as a separate personality, and are not fixing our mind upon that conception of him as pure spirit, which will afford us effectual entry to the springs of his being. We must, therefore, withdraw our thought from the contemplation of symptoms, and indeed from his corporeal personality altogether, and must think of him as a purely spiritual individuality, and as such, entirely free from subjection to any conditions, and consequently, as voluntarily externalizing the conditions most expressive of the vitality and intelligence which pure spirit is. Thinking of him thus, we then make mental affirmation that he shall build up outwardly the correspondence of that perfect vitality which he knows himself to be inwardly. And this suggestion, being impressed by the healer's conscious thought, while the patient's conscious thought is at the same time impressing the fact that he is receiving the active thought of the healer, the result is that the patient's subconscious mind becomes thoroughly imbued with the recognition of its own life-giving power, and according to the recognized law of subjective mentality, proceeds to work out this suggestion into external manifestation, and thus health is substituted for sickness. It must be understood that the purpose of the process here described is to strengthen the subject's individuality, not to dominate it. To use it for domination is inversion, bringing its appropriate penalty to the operator. In this description, I have contemplated the case where the patient is consciously cooperating with the healer, and it is in order to obtain this cooperation that the mental healer usually makes a point of instructing the patient in the broad principles of mental science, if he is not already acquainted with them. But this is not always advisable or possible. Sometimes the statement of principles opposed to existing prejudices arouses opposition, and any active antagonism on the patient's part must tend to intensify the barrier of conscious personality, which it is the healer's first objective to remove. In these cases, nothing is so effective as absent treatment. If the student has grasped all that has been said on the subject of spirit and matter, he will see that in mental treatment, time and space count for nothing, because the whole action takes place on a plane where these conditions do not obtain. And it is therefore quite immaterial whether the patient be in the immediate presence of the healer or in a distant country. Under these circumstances, it is found by experience that one of the most effectual modes of mental healing is by treatment during sleep, because then the patient's whole system is naturally in a state of relaxation which prevents him from offering any conscious opposition to the treatment. And by the same rule, the healer also is able to treat even more effectively during his own sleep than while waking. Before going to sleep, he firmly impresses on his subjective mind that it is to convey curative suggestion to the subjective mind of the patient, and then, by the general principles of the relation between subjective and objective mind, this suggestion is carried out during all the hours that the conscious individuality is wrapped in repose. This method is applicable to young children to whom the principles of the science cannot be explained, and also to persons at a distance. And indeed, the only advantage gained by the personal meeting of the patient and the healer is in the instruction that can be orally given, or when the patient is at that early stage of knowledge where the healer's visible presence conveys the suggestion that something is then being done which could not be done in his absence. Otherwise, the presence or absence of the patient are matters perfectly indifferent. The student must always recollect that the subconscious mind does not have to work through the intellect or conscious mind to produce its curative effects. It is part of the all-pervading creative force of nature, while the intellect is not creative, but distributive. From mental healing, it is but a step to telepathy, clairvoyance, and other kindred manifestations of transcendental power, which are, from time to time, exhibited by the subjective entity, and which follow laws as accurate as those which govern what we are accustomed to consider our more normal faculties. but these subjects do not properly fall within the scope of a book whose purpose is to lay down the broad principles which underlie all spiritual phenomena. Until these are clearly understood, the student cannot profitably attempt the detailed study of the more interior powers, for to do so without a firm foundation of knowledge and some experience in its practical application would only be to expose himself to unknown dangers, and would be contrary to the scientific principle that the advance into the unknown can only be made from the standpoint of the known. Otherwise, we only come into a confused region of guesswork without any clearly defined principles for our guidance.
We trust you are enjoying this Divine Waves production of Thomas Troward's Edinburgh Lectures. Please consider supporting our efforts to bring you additional New Thought classics in audio format. Contributions can be made at servingnewthought.org/donations.htm.